This is KCBX Public Radio for the Central Coast. I'm Father Ian Dellinger, and I'm playing with food. Everyone loves baked goods. Just think of the number of people who learned how to make sourdough bread during lockdown, people who had never even heard of sourdough. And how many people posted that to social media with abandon? Cookies, muffins, croissants. Everyone loves baked goods. But when you are gluten intolerant or have celiac disease, baked goods are literally off the table. Gluten-free baked goods also taste horrible. They are dry and crumbly, hard to swallow, and generally unpleasant. But there are people out there who, very much like the sourdough-crazed pandemic bakers, are feverishly working toward tasty gluten-free products. And that is what is happening right here in San Luis Obispo.
My name is Michael Milch. I'm the owner of Salty Bagel, and I make gluten-free bagels and muffins and banana bread.
What got you started into gluten-free stuff?
I was diagnosed with celiac disease about 10 years ago, and I'd been a pretty avid baker before that. And then it took me a couple of years to get back into baking after my diagnosis because I figured there's no point, it's all going to be terrible. But once I realized that, no, you're able to make incredible stuff that happens to be gluten-free, it was sort of off to the races. Baking is the way I sort of process my days and my emotions. Working with my hands like that is kind of my form of meditation. I've been able to build a business out of it and stay in the kitchen and make stuff that I love to eat.
Has your baking evolved in that time to something that you were okay with to something that you're really happy with?
I do this intensely. Last night I was here till 1:30 in the morning. The night before that I was here till midnight, I think. And it's partially because I have to be, but it's also because I really love it. And I've grown more skillful over the years that I've been doing it because it's not a chore for me. I am really proud of it. It's good stuff that I'm making.
What types of things do you make?
Anything with carbs. I love making bagels and muffins and cookies. I really enjoy making all of it, and I only sell stuff that I'm really proud of. Over here we've got some bagels that are fresh out of the oven.
Ooh, they smell nice.
Yeah. So we've got cheddar and jalapeno, caprese, so heirloom tomato, basil, and mozzarella, feta and garlic, cheddar and onion. Pretty soon we'll have, coming out of the oven, Cayucas hot sauce and jack cheese. If we have time today, we may do some that are gluten-free Cheez-Its and cheddar. Lots of different things, lots of different ways to play with texture and flavor and melt it all together with cheese.
And what are these over here?
These over here, we've got our lemon blueberry muffins, we've got banana bread, chocolate crinkle cookies, and then chocolate chip cookies.
Okay, so what was the most difficult challenge to develop?
I mean, the most difficult challenge wasn't so much the recipe development, it was the fact that I had and have no relevant experience whatsoever. You know, I never worked in the industry, never had my own business, and so I've just been winging it basically for the past 3 years, just trying to grow by hook or by crook. There was a whole period of thinking about it and daydreaming and wishing. I had lost my job at the beginning of the pandemic. You know, obviously our kids were home for school. At the end of the pandemic in June of 21, my dad died. And then my kids went back to school that fall. And so I would find myself in the kitchen and not really having any idea of what to do. And I'd always had this idea of opening a gluten-free pizza place, but never having worked in the industry or done anything like that professionally, it was too daunting. But I have no sense of scale or proportion. And because baking is such a meditative thing for me, I would be in the kitchen all the time at home. And so one day I just decided to try to make gluten-free bagels, and they turned out great, and it all just sort of snapped together at once. I started out in my home kitchen just doing, you know, local drops, grew bit by bit. I was in Kitchen Terminal for a while, thanks to a grant. And then this place opened up almost exactly a year ago.
What can you show me how to make?
Well, let's see. Pizza was the first thing that got me back in the kitchen after I was diagnosed with celiac. Like many other fat people, it's kind of my first love, and it's something I've been working on for a long time. And this is sort of especially special to me because the evolution of all the different things I've been working on, from pizza to baked goods in general to this focaccia, it's allowed me to pour a lot of creative energy into it and a lot of heart, and it's awesome.
Once Mike showed me the pizza he developed, he demonstrated how he makes bagel bites.
So I start with one of these big cubes of dough. Each one of these is about 36 bagels worth. So it's 5.4 kilos. It's about 11, 12 pounds of dough. And each week I usually make about 12 of these.
What is the formula or recipe?
Well, that's a secret. I use King Arthur all-purpose gluten-free flour for everything I make. It's a harder to find blend, but it's the least gritty, it's the most flexible. In the bagel dough, there's also milk and brown sugar and yeast and salt and xanthan gum as a binder. Xanthan gum is one of the critical components of a lot of gluten-free baking because you need something to replace the gluten. It's a binder and it's what gives it some of its structure.
So we have this big blob of dough.
And it almost looks more like spackle or clay or something like that than it does dough. Because it doesn't have the usual stretchy characteristics that you would expect to see in a gluten-based dough. That's the function that gluten usually plays, is it gives dough its stretch or bread its stretch.
Feeling it, it feels like commercial Play-Doh, not the type you make at home, which is gritty and salty, but it feels like the commercial Play-Doh.
Yeah, and then each of the different doughs that I make are different too. Like for example, this is the focaccia batter.
Okay.
And you can see this one is much looser.
Ooh.
Yeah, you can smell it too. It
smells
fermented and yeasty, and this is the basis for not just the focaccia, but for the pizza crusts. The gluten matrix is sort of what traps those carbon dioxide bubbles. You know, if you tear into a piece of bread, you see all the little bubbles in it. So what the xanthan gum does is it makes a similar sort of matrix, but without that sort of stretch. It does it in a sort of different way. It's a hydrocolloid. It loves water, and it'll swell up and form more of a gel. And so as the yeast digests the sugar and puts out carbon dioxide, it traps those bubbles within that matrix. And there are a couple different ingredients that people can use to do that. There's another one that's popular, is psyllium husk, cognac powder, I think that's what it's called. Eventually, all roads lead to Rome, though, and that's what you're trying to do, is trap carbon dioxide gas in a matrix.
Okay, so you're going to make that blob of dough into bagels.
Yes. Well, okay. I'm going to make these into bagel bites. These are what we give out as samples at my booth. And so I try to make these last over the course of the production day, just so that they're freshest when we get there. I've just washed my hands. I dip my fingers in canola oil here, and then I take a 25-gram blob of dough, roll it like this till it's smooth. Boom, bagel bite.
You're listening to KCBX Public Radio for the Central Coast. I'm Father Ian with Michael Milch telling me all about how to make gluten-free baked goods and how to make them taste good. It's now time to mix some dough. What's mixing dough like?
Mixing gluten-free dough is easier and a lot more difficult than gluten-based dough. It's easier because I can just plop everything in a stand mixer. You know, I don't have to knead it. I don't have to let it rise a couple times. That said, the much trickier part is the weights are critical, you know, and the ratios of things are critical. These are my recipe cheat sheets, but you can see how specific everything is. For the bagel dough, I use in each batch of 36 bagels exactly 32 grams of xanthan gum. If you go too heavy with it, it becomes a lot denser. If you go too loose, it's a much stickier mass. That's part of the challenge. The other part of the challenge, and where a lot of people go wrong trying to bake gluten-free stuff, is that a lot of it is very specific to the flour that you're using, because there's so many different blends. You know, the blend that I use is rice flour and potato starch and tapioca. And so it's going to behave differently than a different one-for-one that also might have xanthan gum already added, or a lot of them use powdered cellulose as a filler and stabilizer. There are more and better products available, but what you have to realize is that, as in vegan cheese, so in gluten-free food, there aren't nearly as many people doing it. And so just by sheer numbers alone, if you have a lot fewer people doing it, you're going to have a lot fewer people doing it well. And it's going to make it harder to find the people and the products that are doing it well.
When you say not very many people doing it, you've got Bob's Red Mill and King Arthur doing your mixes for you. That's pretty big.
Well, they're making flours. They're not making final products.
True.
And I think that's the difference. You could always find the components to it. You know, rice flour's been around as long as we have. But people making stuff like this with rice flour is a much more recent development. But the more people who do it, just by sheer force of numbers, the higher the likelihood that you're going to find something that's palatable and passable. Gluten-free food has a reputation for being awful, and that reputation is largely deserved, but it's correlation, not causation. It just so happens that a lot of people have been doing really gnarly things with gluten-free food, and people don't really know how to handle them, too. Gluten-free food, if it's not fresh, needs to be reheated, and it needs to be reheated the right way. Otherwise, that's when you get that sort of gritty texture that you picture when you think of, or that at least I would picture when I think of gluten-free food. Not knowing that, you could have a wonderful product, but if it's not readied the same way that it needs to be, or that it's intended to be, it's going to be terrible.
the other component for people who find themselves out of mainstream, mm-hmm. they settle.
Yeah, absolutely. That goes back to what I was saying after diagnosis. There's a huge feeling of loss and of mourning because I thought I was never going to have good pizza again. I thought I was never going to have decent bread again or pasta or any of these things because it's difficult to find and it's difficult to know which are the good brands, which aren't the good brands. It's difficult to know who's doing it right. And so all you know is that these things that I used to be able to eat with abandon, I can no longer eat with abandon. I can't even really approach them anymore. And so until you realize what the different alternatives are and their strengths and their weaknesses and what you like and what you don't like, you constantly feel like you're settling at best. And that's also assuming that you have a supportive cast around you of family and loved ones, because you'll hear about a lot of people whose family just doesn't get it and doesn't try to get it. It makes life incredibly difficult.
If you look at the pizza joints around town, the higher end pizza joints all have gluten-free crusts. Do you rate any of them?
You'll also notice that a lot of those places, if they know at all what they're doing, will also say that they're prepared in an environment where there's also a lot of flour because it aerolyzes so easily, and so they can't guarantee that it's free of cross-contamination. So if somebody's gluten-free because they're mildly discomforted by it or something short of celiac, you know, that's one thing, but for people with celiac, they'll say that you can't do it, and I generally won't. Flour will hang in the air for a day or two. If you do a lot of baking, you can see what that's like. You know, you can clean up and then come back an hour or two later and there's a light covering of flour on everything. And again, it takes so little to set off a celiac reaction that you realize right away it's no good. If your home is not generally kept gluten-free, baking for people who are celiac in particular is tricky because like scratches in non-stick surfaces, for example, can hide traces of gluten. One of the first things that they recommend, in fact, when you're diagnosed is to go through and basically throw out most of your stuff because it's so cross-contaminated in ways that you can't really do anything about.
You're listening to KCBX Public Radio for the Central Coast. I'm Father Ian, and gluten-free baker Michael Milch just started telling me some of the issues with gluten intolerance, but it goes further than that. Let's hear more about celiac disease.
Well, I can speak to celiac in particular. It's an autoimmune disease, and it's triggered by the most ridiculously small amounts of gluten. When I say small amounts, we're talking under 10 parts per million, which is a speck of a speck of a speck. When you have celiac disease and you ingest gluten, your body just goes on high alert and attacks itself. All the little fingers in your small intestines are killed off, basically, or blunted when you've had active untreated celiac for a long time. So practically speaking, you wind up unable to absorb a lot of nutrients. I was super anemic when I was diagnosed. My path to diagnosis started when I tried to donate blood, and I was turned away because I was too anemic. They're also finding that more and more autoimmune disorders seem like they're gluten modulated as well. Either it's kicking off some sort of inflammatory response or something. Autoimmune disorders rarely fit within specific neat categories. It's one of the things that makes them so difficult to diagnose. For example, in celiac, thinking back, you know, I've always had stomach issues. I just thought that was sort of how my body was. It didn't really bother me, but probably about 20 years ago, I was really having a lot of brain fog, a lot of malaise, just achiness and things like that. And it was easy enough for my doctors to write off as brain fog. You know, you just stop complaining. I was living in New York, so everybody was neurotic. But in retrospect, so many of those things are classic symptoms of going through this difficulty with gluten. Now they're realizing there's gluten ataxia. You can suffer neurological damage. It's gnarly stuff. It's just a deeper and deeper rabbit hole.
Do you ever have cheat days?
Never, because there would be nothing fun about it. For me, so much of food is the act of being able to enjoy it, you know, with other people or even on my own. And that's one of the most difficult things about a celiac diagnosis is that you go through almost this period of mourning because you realize that the way you used to eat and the things you used to eat are not really open to you anymore. You basically stop eating out at restaurants because you quickly find that not many of them are trustworthy. they're well-meaning, but because it takes so little to kick off a celiac reaction, if they're not really well-trained and well-versed in preventing cross-contamination, it's really easy to get dosed. And it still happens to me every once in a while, and it's super unpleasant. I don't know that I would have been able to go gluten-free had I not been diagnosed with celiac, because it seems so daunting, and it is so daunting. But I was so sick when I was diagnosed, and it was one of those things where you just sort of had to rip off the Band-Aid. Traveling is incredibly stressful. It's so case by case. There are different apps that'll give you reviews and from other people who are avoiding gluten. There's one called Find Me Gluten Free, where you can research all the different places ahead of time. You quickly discover that that's a pretty critical component of traveling like this. A little bit of flour goes a long way in making your life miserable. There are a lot of places that handle it well, and you come to recognize that pretty quickly. But there are others where, you know, if you're in a place where they really don't have any conception of cross-contamination control, it takes so little to do damage. You can't use stuff that's in a shared fryer, for example. And it seems silly, you know. If you've never dealt with it yourself or have a family member who's dealt with something like that, it's hard to believe, maybe, that it's as severe and as strict as people say it is. But just the particles in a shared fryer will get you sick. You really come to cherish finding places that have dedicated fryers, for example, because it means you're going to have fries again.
What about on the beverages side of things? Because the bottles are labeled gluten-free,
yes.
But anything distilled is going to be gluten-free anyway, right?
Correct. That's the one bit of good news in all of this, is that you can still drink away your tears, as long as you're not drinking beer. Although there are some pretty high-quality gluten-free beers around now. I used to be a beer drinker, and I lost my taste for it, because in retrospect, one of the things that made sense about the celiac diagnosis was the last time I had a bottle of beer at home is the closest I ever came to calling an ambulance for myself. I don't even have words to describe how terrible it felt, but you just sort of feel like you're going down. And I had also had that feeling after a weekend of baking as well, just all of a sudden going kind of dizzy and sweaty. And I'm dizzy and sweaty under the best of circumstances, but it was in a scary, unpleasant way. And eventually it passed, thankfully, but it was severe enough to be memorable. The country that's supposedly easiest to travel in with celiac is Italy, believe it or not.
With all the pasta?
With all the pasta, they have the highest rate of celiac diagnosis in the world. And I don't know if it's because they test more thoroughly, if they test more people, or if it's some function of their sense of hospitality. But from what I understand, and from what I'd like to experience myself, most places have celiac-safe options. And in fact, the government subsidizes people with celiac because the food costs are so much higher. So they actually give you a stipend every month to offset some of those costs.
That's really interesting, because there is so much pasta and focaccia as you are making. Mm-hmm. Is there a link between consumption of gluten causing celiac, or is it caused by some other mechanism?
No, it's some other mechanism. So to come down with celiac disease, you have to have the genes for it. And then they think there's some sort of environmental trigger, and what that is, they don't really know. But it's not a function of how much wheat you eat or anything like that. It's a genuine autoimmune condition. My daughter, who's now 12, was also diagnosed with celiac when she was about 5. In a lot of ways, she's very lucky that we caught it that young, because catching it that young, you're able to mitigate a lot of the damage that you might otherwise see. Watching her deal with the social aspects of it is so difficult. She's got great friends and supportive teachers, and it's nothing to do with that, but it's just the idea of the othering of it. You know, not being able to eat the same foods as everybody else, having to answer questions from well-meaning people. Don't want to be the center of attention in that way.
Now it was time to see the final products and to do some tasting. Can gluten-free baked goods taste good? And what do we have here?
We have, looks like plain sesame, salt, one onion, one garlic, there's some onion cheddar, and everything. My name is Sarah, and I help out Mike in the kitchen.
What are you making today?
I just unwrapped the focaccia, and I'm going to top them off with our mixture of garlic powder, basil, oregano, or as the label says, oregano, yes, and some salt.
Whose idea was oregano, yes?
That would be Mike's. I am making the flatbread. I've just pulled it out from the freezer, and I'm going to top it off with basil leaves, sliced tomatoes. After it bakes and it cools off, then I'll drizzle on some balsamic vinegar.
How is the flatbread different than the focaccia?
it's not as lofty. It's flatter. It's a bit more crisp. It's much lower in hydration.
This is the chocolate crinkle cookie, is that what it's called?
Yes.
I'm gonna try this. It tastes exactly like a chocolate crinkle cookie. Mm-hmm. I mean, I haven't had one for a long time, but it's just good.
If things are fresh and they're prepared correctly, they're all but indistinguishable from something that's more conventionally made.
It's a bit softer. Is that because of baking time or xanthan gum?
That's baking time and also because they're still so fresh out of the oven.
Fresh is best.
Fresh is best.
It's really good.
Thank you.
Yeah.
I had already tasted the bagel bite at the farmer's market, and I had a jalapeno bagel with cream cheese later on. The bagels indeed had the taste and texture of a real bagel. I took cookies and muffins to my dad and my brother, who are both allergic to wheat, and my sister-in-law, who has celiac disease. They thought these were some of the most tasty, gluten-free morsels they've eaten in a long time. That great taste and quality product came from more than just following a recipe. It came from a place of passion. Michael expressed it this way.
I came at it from a place where I loved baking, and I'm not going to put out anything that I don't love. You know, the whole saying, something's made with love. Sometimes it's made with disdain too, but if it's made honestly and it's made enthusiastically, that's the key to everything. That means you're willing to put in the hours to get better and it's not a chore. As soon as it's a bummer, you're out.
And that's the best part about buying and eating local. Love, honesty, and enthusiasm. This is KCPX Public Radio for the Central Coast. I'm Father Ian and I'm playing with food.